Tuesday, August 22nd, began sluggishly, for me that is, but turned into a crescendo day at the White House. Lyndon was awake by 7, and I sleepwalked into my own room and fitfully and unsuccessfully courted sleep. Gave up a little past 9, and then bathed and dressed rapidly because I got the word that Walter Washington was still in Lyndon's office, and it would be a good idea if I came over. I walked in to find him with a big smile, just saying goodbye to Lyndon, and I had the feeling that things had gone well, and that maybe it would work out for him to be our next mayor. I hope so. We had a brief, warm exchange, for me, full of the work we'd done together on our committee, and then I went back upstairs to see Nat Owings in the Queen's room. He wanted to talk to me about Las Trampas, a little community of 100 Mexican families high in the mountains of New Mexico, off the beaten track, practically congealed in the customs and architecture and way of life of 200 years ago. Actually, their very own ancestors came there before our Revolutionary War. His interest, of course, is historic preservation, especially of the lovely old church. And then he talked of the Pennsylvania Avenue plan and the commission which he would head, and which at present is just getting along on a temporary planning stage basis, not officially blessed by Congress. He hoped that the bill officially creating it would be passed this session, and that Lyndon would write a letter to Aspinall urging that it be done. I spent the rest of the morning working with Bess and with Ashton and having lunch on a tray, and then I stretched out in bed and read about Iran and had a shampoo and set, off and on casting a prayer skyward because we'd hoped to have the ballet outside and the shell had been built for that purpose. The changing weather predictions for the last 2 days have kept us on knife's edge, and it looks grayer every hour. A little before 5, I went over to Lyndon's office. He'd lain down to rest in his room for a few minutes. There's been no chance for a nap today, and he was just getting up. It was almost on the dot of 5 when we went out on the south lawn for the arrival of the Shah. The sky was gray and lowering, but the scene was bright as always, with the flags and the stiff lines of military men, the trumpets circling the balcony above, and the eager, expectant people lining the driveway as we walked past. A little ripple of applause crested with us as we walked along the driveway. And there was the Secretary of State, calm and smiling as always. I never cease to marvel at the personal peace he has attained in the midst of the turmoil of his job. Then the Shah drove up. Each time I have seen him, and now there have been 3 or 4 times, it is, quite simply, a thrill. He is a romantic figure, with the look of a poet in his face, and he looks at each person, I think, as though he were really seeing you, listening to you with interest. It's a great compliment. I hope I can learn from it. Lyndon, in his speech of welcome, spoke of our several meetings with the Shah and of Iran's economy, which has been growing at about 10% a year, and her gains against illiteracy. You are winning progress without violence and bloodshed, a lesson others have still to learn. And then the Shah, speaking without notes, in perfect English but rather hesitantly, made a brief, earnest talk, disarming in its simplicity and its complete difference from the trite lines that are often read in a monotone voice. After the brief line in the diplomatic reception room, Lyndon took him over to the office to talk, and I went back upstairs. I'd already greeted S.B. Wittenberg from Amarillo and the Dick Browns from Austin, who were our house guests. The Marshal Steves had arrived by train, the last remaining people who don't fly, and I just hoped they'd gotten here in time to watch the ceremony. Dean Rusk had told Lyndon that he had received 66 foreign chiefs of state in the last 12 months, and though a good many of these had been at Guam and Manila or just working visits, a great many indeed had been state guests with just this arrival ceremony. And yet the color, the trumpets, the ritual never fails to thrill me. Marilyn, who is in charge of house guests and loves it, and also of special tours, came in to tell me that there was a little group downstairs. They'd had their tour and witnessed their arrival and were just about to leave, and would I like to go down and say hello? I did. There was a sizable Marshall contingent, the Reverend and Mrs. Richelle of the Episcopal Church, with their 2 children. They're all Phillips and Murdy's friends, and the couple they're staying with, Dr. and Mrs. Price, and Diana Miller, a young school teacher, taking a job here in Maryland, whose mother had been nurse to my daddy in his last days, and she'd brought her roommate. She put in my arms a present that almost made me feel like crying, a handmade afghan done by her mother. It must have meant hours and hours of her life. She hoped I'd be able to use it somewhere at the ranch. When I thanked her, she laughingly said, "This is Mother's therapy. She does it to keep her mind off troubles." People, people, what a place this is from which to see them, to learn about them. In all the best, the most generous and noble, and in all the worst. And there was Bill Deason and Jeannie, with a whole houseful of their kinfolks, the Elmo Spears and their children, some 8 or 9 assorted relatives. I spent a few minutes shaking hands all around and getting pictures taken and giving autographs, and then went back upstairs for a little rest before getting my hair combed, putting on my Irish Stavropoulos dress, the usual trauma of the last few minutes in which Bess and I from our end and Jimmy Symington and some unknown protocol officer from the other end tried to bring Lyndon and the visiting chief of state to the steps of the North Portico at precisely the same moment. How much we miss the Empress. When a visiting chief of state has a wife as beautiful as she is, there's that hushed moment of excitement after he's gotten out, when you wait for her to emerge from the big black car, eager to see what she is wearing, how she has her hair done, what jewels. She is an ornament to her husband and to her country, as is the Queen of Thailand, perhaps the two outstanding ones I have met. When young Mrs. Ansari, the wife of the new ambassador from Iran, her baby nicely timed and by now just about a month old, was glamorous, quite beautiful, in a long beaded gown, her hair falling over her shoulders. The minister of court, Mr. Alam, whom I have known through 3 visits, is as suave and charming as any visitor I can remember. And it was a pleasure to see Ambassador and Mrs. Armin Meyer. He had been our ambassador to Lebanon when we had visited there, and she had taken me out to Baalbek. Hubert and Muriel were there, his eternal spring of ebullience somewhat subdued, because his brother is dying. And Muriel never looked lovelier, in a pale pink and silver dress, faintly Japanese in design, that she had had done for her trip to Japan. We had the exchange of gifts, and once more I have to remark in my mind that it is an art to receive gifts, to express appreciation, an art well worth cultivating, because it gives so much pleasure to the giver. It's simply a social asset, and the Shah made us feel very pleased. Although the gifts were scarcely remarkable, ours, that is. A painting of a beach landscape, a Vermeer desk box with the outlines of the USA and Iran. The inscription does matter. And a letter saying that 5 Bradford pear trees would be sent to the Empress for her garden when planting time came. You understand they have a new home of their own. And some bowling balls, 1 for each of them. He said yes, oh, they did love it, and they bowled together a lot. Mm-hmm. And for the children, 2 Walt Disney films, Beaver Valley and Bear Country. For this, I think Bess certainly gets an A. And as for theirs, their gifts were indeed breathtaking. The figure of a horse about 15 inches high, a museum treasure. It was over 2,000 years old. And my mind hurtled forward to the time when someday we'll put together an exhibit of artifacts, my very own and state gifts, in the Lyndon Johnson Library. And there were 2 handsome Persian rugs. Linda came in looking breathtaking, her hair piled high and curls falling over her shoulder, wearing a blue and silver dress that had a peacock feather motif. This she had bought especially for the dinner for the Shah, when she'd first heard he was coming. The colors preceded us down the great stairway. I walked with Mr. Alam. And then after the pictures at the bottom, the 3 of us walked side by side into the East Room. From the cabinet, beside the rusk, there were the U-Dolls, a sizable contingent from the Senate, our old friend Clint Anderson from New Mexico and Henrietta, and Mike and Maureen Mansfield, the Winston Prouties and Ed Longs, and the Claiborne Pells. There's so much I like about them, their looks, their interest in art, and yet there's so little that he seems to find a support in the Johnson administration. And young Senator Howard Baker, without joy, who is ill, he said. Bob Casey was among the congressmen. And when we had heard just the day before that the Iranian official party would not be the usual 10 that we reserve for the visitors, but I think about 5, I then invited two other Texas congressmen, the Ray Roberts, who'd been invited to the British dinner and couldn't come, and I knew would be really thrilled to come for the first time to a state affair, and the John Youngs, who'd been with us on enough personal evenings, boat trips, our Sunday evenings at home, that a last-minute invitation would be an intimate compliment and not a slight. And that gentleman whose friendship has been one of my prized possessions